Case number 4, Appeal 22-1817, USA versus Ernest Russell. Mr. Hillis. Hi, Mr. Hillis.
Hey, Judge. How are you today?
Yeah, here. It's Valentine's Day. My favorite day of the year.
It's a sweet occasion to be up here. Should I begin?
Of course.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Daniel Hillis. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Russell on this appeal. Mr. Russell is here because he's not concerned about the amount of time that he has to serve in prison. He accepts that he committed a drug offense and has to serve time in prison as a result of that. But as part of the district court's determination for what the proper sentence would be, it said that he should also have to endure a sex offender condition. My client's not a sex offender. He's never been convicted of any sex offense. And so this additional aspect of the punishment is improper here. And the district court should not have imposed the sex offender condition given the lack of evidence in this case. I'll touch briefly on the standard of review. Oh, go ahead, Judge.
Weren't the facts underlying that, 2010 domestic battery conviction, a sufficient basis for a court to require him to be assessed for sex offender treatment? I agree, 12 years has passed without any similar conduct, as far as we know, but does the passage of time alone preclude a requirement that the defendant be assessed to determine whether treatment is appropriate?
It is a highly salient fact. And so we would look to the court's decision, for instance, in the U.S. versus Monterico Johnson case that we cite, and other cases have also talked about temporal proximity. And as the passage of time increases, the likelihood of the need for the condition dissipates considerably. In this case, when Judge Rovner we have here, there was never a conviction for a sex offense. And so there's a domestic conviction, of course, but there's nothing more than an allegation of a sex offense. And this is a complete lack of proof. The district court has a PSR, and the PSR just has a summary by a probation officer of a police report. A police report is not valid proof of any fact in a case, and especially so when it is disputed. And so we know for all sorts of reasons in the course of advocacy, a police officer might write up a report to submit in furtherance of a prosecution. We don't assume that the information that's in the police report is correct, and certainly when it's been disputed at sentencing as it is here, we do not have enough facts. The government would at that point, if it wished to pursue the condition, bring in a witness in order to support it. Otherwise, what we have on the record at the time, I see a finger.
You're suggesting, I take it, that because Mr. Russell disputed the sexual nature of the 2010 offense, the government was required to present additional evidence?
I am.
But Mr. Leinenweber, his attorney, never made the objection below. In other words, I'm not sure why Judge Chang would have been on notice that he needed to convene an evidentiary hearing.
Well, Judge, if the evidence was an equipoise because of the PSR and a lack of objection, then that may be one thing. But my client is entitled to speak on his own behalf and advocate when necessary. We do have instances, and we've seen it before, where it's been a matter of criminal history, where the points are stated to be such, and then the defendant will stand up or inform the court that that number is incorrect, or I don't have three felonies, I have one. And so that is enough to put a judge on notice, because that is now triggering the judge, alerting the judge that there's a dispute. And it's not coming just by the lawyer, incidentally. This is a person who's under oath and telling the judge something. So this is testimony, and it is something to give Judge Chang an opportunity to then hear additional evidence on it if the condition is deemed to be in play.
And in fact, there was an objection. Leinenweber did object.
He did. He elected not to say anything further. He said, I stand on my objection. It was just that it was elaborated upon by the defendant, which I think is important here, because the government's saying the lack of details can be a problem that works against the defendants in these circumstances. But here we have additional details, Judge. So that is the point that I wish to make about that. It may seem out of order, but I'll touch back on the standard of review. this is a de novo review issue because de novo review is appropriate when the district court has not adequately considered the 3553A factors or when it has not sufficiently explained the basis for its sentence. We have both problems here because we've got the temporal proximity, which isn't really discussed by the judge in my memory. The judge talks about what the allegations were, but the focus in a lot of the cases that we cite in our brief is about the amount of time. The passage of time is critical here. And so even if the PSR says it's 12 years, the judge in his explanation of sentence and his determination about whether the condition is appropriate should make that a prominent feature in the analysis. And so
does it matter, Mr. Hillis, the standard of review, de novo or abuse of discretion? By your analysis, seems to me, if we take your argument, you win under abuse of discretion as well.
I would like to win under any standard, but I think that
can you explain to us why you're cleaving to this de novo review?
It's not the fight for today, but it's also the ammunition for tomorrow. And so we would like to have de novo review apply in circumstances where we come up because it makes it a harder case when we have to prevail under plain error or under any other standard of review. De novo is our best standard. It's what we'd like to be able to cling to in this case. And it's like the thing that we'd like to rely on again in a future case.
Okay.
So it's important. But I agree. I mean, look, an opinion can be written up, and you folks know how to write opinions far better than I can write them or read them. But we'd say we don't need to reach the standard of review. And I think we've seen that in other cases. I'm trying to recall if it was in Kappas or Thompson, where the court said the standard review isn't determinative here. You win under whatever the standard review is. And I think it was plain error in those instances. So we don't need to address it head on. I'm just saying that it is an important consideration because the government brought it up. I'll at least take the opportunity to respond. Lastly, another thing that we don't necessarily need to reach, but it is in the brief and I'll touch upon it, is the improper delegation here. When we allow Article III judges to exercise their authority, we expect that only the Article III judge will impose the punishment. And here is part of the sentence, which is part of the punishment. There's the sex offender condition, and in the judgment, it's under Special Condition 15, it lets the treatment provider determine if treatment is necessary. So it's binary, it's a toggle. It's on or off. If it is allowing somebody else to determine whether the punishment is imposed or not imposed, and that other entity isn't the district court, then we have a delegation problem. And under Spendthrift Farms or Schrody, Supreme Court case and Seventh Circuit case, respectively, we have a problem here. And so with that...
But the condition only gives the probation officer the authority to pick the provider who performs the assessment. If treatment's recommended, then a court order is required before Mr. Russell could be compelled to undergo treatment. And I take it at that time, Mr. Russell would be free to raise whatever objection he wanted to such a proposal. I'm not sure I understand how this condition grants too much discretion to the probation officer.
It's the treatment provider that we're concerned about, Judge. So if we're considering an administrative discretionary function of the probation officer to select the program, that's one thing. But the second sentence in the judgment, which is docket entry 123, page 6, it says, if treatment is deemed necessary by the provider, the government mm-hmm. or the probation department may seek an order from the court for the defendant to comply with the recommended treatment. So that language suggests to me that it is the treatment provider who gets to deem whether treatment is necessary.
Well, what else would the treatment provider do?
Make a recommendation, and then it's for the court to...
That's exactly what it says.
That's
exactly what it says, no. Because the court has to decide.
Recommendation, not deemed necessary. It's a conclusion that it is necessary, and therefore the court is allowing the probation officer...
Well, if it's not necessary, what would he recommend to the court?
It's not for the court to make the determination, is our gloss on this.
No, Mr. Hillis, if the treatment, if they did the evaluation of the treatment, whoever was doing the analysis determined the treatment was not necessary,
right.
There's no action for him or her to take. That's the point.
Sure.
It's only if they determine treatment is necessary do they go to the court and seek an order.
That's right.
So how is that delegation of anything?
Well, it's allowing the treatment provider, based on the language that's in the condition, to make the first determination whether or not it's a necessary thing. By allowing the treatment provider to say that treatment is necessary instead of the district court making the finding.
In my view, well, the district court doesn't do the evaluation.
No, the district court needs to make the determination. The treatment provider can make an assessment and submit its finding to the district court, but it's for the district court to make the determination whether the aspect of punishment should be imposed. That's all we're saying on that. We think that it is by far a secondary problem in this case. The primary problem is about whether the condition should have been imposed in the first place. In our view, clearly it shouldn't. It's not supported by the facts or the law. With that, I reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you very much. Okay. Mr. Kaluri, hello.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Prashant Kaluri on behalf of the United States. The district court did not abuse its discretion in imposing a supervised condition that required the defendant to undergo a sex offender assessment. At sentencing, the court was confronted with credible information that the defendant had had sexual contact with an 11-year-old victim, his stepdaughter. In determining an appropriate sentence aimed at rehabilitating the defendant and protecting the public upon defendant's release, the court imposed a fairly modest condition of a sex offender assessment, which was a step back from what the probation department had recommended, which was an assessment and treatment. In so ruling, the court had found that the information in the PSR about the defendant's conviction for domestic battery of the 11-year-old was reliable, and it was based on the detailed facts reported about the incident, the contemporaneous phone call that the victim made to her mother.
Mr. Kaluri, as I'm sure you're aware, our case law says that police reports are not categorically presumed to be reliable without more information or corroborating information. So was there any additional information that the district court relied upon or considered other than the report of this police report in the PSR that we are not aware of?
Your Honor, no. The district court focused on the information in the police report and made a determination based on the facts.
Let me help you there. Don't you think that the district court considered what the defendant told the district court at sentencing?
It did, Your Honor. So it was two things. It was what was in the police report, and then it was the defendant's own statements during his elocution, some of which corroborated that a sexual contact happened when the defendant said that the incident caused a rift in the marriage and that the victim moved out of the home after the incident. And in addition to those other statements, the defendant made a number of other statements about the incidents that amounted to nothing more than bare denials. Mr. Hillis claims that there was a dispute here. There was no dispute. The defendant's statements were that the incident was a misdemeanor and not a felony, that it was some he said, she said stuff, but he never went into what the he said portion of it was, that he pled guilty to get out of jail, and that he was not a sex offender, which rejects the label but doesn't reject the underlying conduct. So there was no dispute here. So we have what was in the police report and the district court's finding that it was sufficiently detailed and then given the age of the victim and that the conviction was for domestic battery. And the court noted that given the young age of the victim, an 11-year-old girl, that those cases often are pled down. And so we have a conviction here.
And do you have any idea, because I don't, reading the transcript, where that comes from? What's the basis of the district court's knowledge on about that particular fact?
My understanding would be it was the district court's probably that judge's experience with these types of cases. There was nothing more than it was, you know, kind of assumed that it was in his experience. These types of cases are pled down given the young age of the victims. And then
Words, they don't want to force the victim to testify.
That's correct, Your Honor. And then the other thing to note that the PSR does show is that the defendant pled guilty 15 days after the incident. And there's a domestic battery here. So there's this the dispute on whether this was a sex offense. We're not saying that domestic battery is a sex offense, but he pled guilty to a domestic battery. We know who he battered within his home, and we know what the battery was based on what's in the police report, which was unrebutted at sentencing.
How is the condition reasonably related to Mr. Russell's offense?
It's not related to his drug offense, which was the instant offense of conviction, but we have an instance here where we have a sexual contact or domestic battery with an 11-year-old, and there was no record in the PSR that the defendant had ever ever undergone any assessment or sex offender treatment. So I think you put those two things together, and we have a reasonable basis. The district court had a reasonable basis to impose the sex offender assessment.
Now, one thing I'm still not clear of after your brief is how you distinguish this case from a case like Johnson.
Johnson is a treatment case, Your Honor. And so this court has held, and other circuits have held as well, that there can't be a lot of remoteness if a district court between a sex offense or sex offense conviction and the imposition of a supervised release condition that requires treatment.
But in Johnson, we talked about things other than treatment. For example, we talked about the lack of a temporal connection and the fact that the government didn't explain why sex offender treatment was necessary at that point to rehabilitate Johnson or protect the public. That's a quote from Johnson. We also noted there was no suggestion that Johnson had engaged in any sexual misconduct since the 1997 misdemeanor. So those are just but two examples. The discussion in Johnson is a little bit broader than just the question of treatment versus assessment.
Well, Your Honor, I also think it's a combination of two things. It's the time that has elapsed since the sex offense or sex offense type conduct, and what's in the record as to what treatment or assessment the defendant has had. And in this instance, you have a period of 12 years, which is a decent amount of time, but there was also no evidence in the PSR that the defendant had ever had an assessment or a treatment. And again, when going back on the context of the information about the sex offense was unrebutted, it was, again, a fairly modest imposition to have Mr. Russell undergo a sex offender assessment. Particularly given the young age of the victim.
Am I right in thinking that by the time Mr. Russell is assessed in the future, it's going to be nearly 20 years after the 2010 domestic battery incident?
That's correct, Your Honor. Probably about 18 to 20 years.
Assuming there are no other incidents of sexual misconduct that come to light between now and then, would a court be justified in requiring sex offender treatment at that time?
I believe so, Your Honor, and I think the district court recognized that in that one incident should be enough, particularly when left unaddressed.
Well, courts do that all the time, right? Because often sex offenders get extraordinarily lengthy sentences, and then upon release, they need to be assessed or treated.
Do we run?
We don't just say because of someone who's engaging in child pornography offenses is sentenced to 40 years, sex offender assessment is unnecessary, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's just a standard condition.
Correct.
But I wonder, do we run into a problem when we treat a sexual assault allegation in a police report the same as a sex offense conviction?
Well, the Ross case is instructive there in the sense that in Ross, it was a sex offender assessment case, but there was no underlying sex conviction. It was a conviction for making false statements to the FBI. But the defendant in that instance made statements to the FBI as well that he was involved in a child sex ring. And I think they were all statements that were deemed false, but there was enough concern there that the court held that those types of statements warranted a sex offender assessment.
So you're analogizing the statements in Ross to whatever facts we have here in Russell?
Well, I actually think, Your Honor, that what we have here is stronger given that we have a conviction for domestic battery as well as victim statements about what happened that were, again, detailed and followed by a contemporaneous phone call to the mother. And then defendant's statements at his sentencing would seem to indicate that there was a sexual assault based on the aftermath of what happened.
If we ignore police reports and we require instances like this, we say we're not going to consider domestic battery as a history and characteristic or the nature and circumstance of the offense as detailed in the police report, we're going to force 11-year-old victims to get on the witness stand and testify in order that there be a sex offense conviction so that in the event in the future the defendant may be subject to sex offense treatment or assessment. Boy, it's a scary world.
I agree, Your Honor. And I think that the district court was faced with this dilemma. It had three options based on the information before it. It either followed probation's recommendation of an assessment and treatment, it order an assessment, or it do nothing in this instance of a defendant who was reported to have attacked an 11-year-old girl. And so it chose a compromise and I think very reasonable position of let's get him assessed because he's never been assessed before.
The do-nothing could also have contemplated rely on the state court to have resolved this in the way that it saw fit at the time of the state case.
It could have, and I think, Your Honor, and that's why the district court made its finding that, you know, these cases are often pled down because of the impact that they have on the victim to get a victim up on the stand and to have her testify about what her stepfather just did. And so if we have, you know, again, in the district court's experience, if you have this instance where a defendant's willing to plead guilty to a domestic battery, I think oftentimes in state courts, based on experience, that's what happens. It's unfortunate, but it's what happens.
Well, it's not even unfortunate. I mean, they deal with what? How many tens of thousands of cases every year?
That's correct. So, I see my time is up unless Your Honors have any additional questions. We would ask that the sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kaluri. Mr. Hillis. Give Mr. Hillis the time that he requested.
Thank you, Judge. I appreciate that. It's a scary world when we allow allegations instead of proof to form the basis for punishment when we have an evidentiary-based system. So I'll begin with that. We shouldn't also allow district courts to speculate about what happens in a case to then justify the imposition of punishment. We don't allow speculation. We've said this in too many cases that I could even count. District courts aren't supposed to impose punishment based on their own speculation. And I don't know if there's anything in the record that shows that this was
what was the district court speculating here?
Well, I thought that it was just said that the charge would have been pled down for it to be a domestic as opposed to...
I mean, are you
to,
saying that district judges cannot rely upon their experience and all they need to consider is what's in front of them? They have to throw everything... Common sense. I mean, we've got to tell juries you can't rely on common sense anymore. If it's not right in front of you, what about circumstantial evidence? Is that out too?
No, just speculation of this type because
but,
we don't...
But how is that speculation? If a judge is relying on his experience, it's less than common sense that these cases are routinely pled down. So 10-year-olds do not have to get on the stand and repeat the sexual assault that was performed against them. Well, everybody knows that.
I don't think that there was any proof of sexual assault. Here's the problem, Judge, that there's nothing to say that that occurred such that it was ever charged in that fashion, therefore pled down. But I don't want to miss the opportunity to mention the other points that we're not here in a situation where we're talking about somebody who's been convicted of something presently, 30 years elapsed, there's a condition that applies later. This is something where it happened in 2010, and we're talking now about the condition. So it's a completely different circumstance.
It's a different circumstance.
So that's important here. And then lastly, it is not the case that this is an 11-year-old victim who would be pressed upon to provide testimony. This is somebody who was 11, I think, at the time. So the passage of time, this person may be in their 20s by now. I think that if it is something the government really insists on having, a condition of this type, that the victim would come in and testify, and I think it's something the district court would want to hear about. And finally, the passage of time and for why nothing happened, I think it was because it was fairly evident to a jurist at the moment that this was not a necessary condition. So there's never an order for treatment. There was not a domestic conviction that precipitated the need for that. It's not as if this is something where he's been untreated for all this time and for no reason. The reason he hasn't been treated is because the condition was never appropriate in the first place, and it was never imposed, and it shouldn't have been imposed here based on the evidence. And we cannot make too little of the proximity issue here. The temporal proximity is a crucial feature, and it just wasn't something that was focused upon by the district court in its analysis like it should have been. I have nothing further.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hillis, and thank you so much, Mr. Kaluri. Much appreciated. And the case will be taken under advisement.